asking why a lot, you know, can lead you down this really interesting path of discovery to understand consumer behavior.
This is Real Talk, the customer insights show with Jen Vogel, a top-rated live stream and podcast in the market research and insights industry. We stream live on LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and you can listen on all major podcast channels. Join Jen and her guests for a weekly discussion around topics that will help you understand your customers better. Real Talk is presented to you by Vox PopMe, the leader in video research and ranked number one in qualitative research by Grit 2 years running. Here's today's conversation.
Hello, insights professionals, marketers, and everyone who wants to understand their customers better. I'm your host, Jen Vogel. You might recall a couple months ago, back in October, I believe, we shared on an episode that Vox PopMe had acquired HubUX. And with that acquisition, it's now easier than ever to run, set up, recruit, schedule virtual focus groups, and then also analyze them on the back end. But what goes into moderating a virtual focus group and what should be considered to make it a success? To discuss that topic, I'm bringing back Jamin Brazil, founder of HubUX, to the show. Welcome back. So good to have you here.
It is an honor to be part of the show again. Thank you for including me, Jen.
I'm so glad you're here. The last time you were on the show, we were not working together. Now we are. And this is so fun.
Super fun for me. It has been an absolute highlight.
Awesome. So before we get into the topic for today's conversation, we have a new question we've been asking all of our guests. And I want to ask you, what does agile mean to you?
It's a funny question, really, isn't it?
It is.
In a lot of ways, I feel like agile is completely overused. You know, when you think about the pace of business, the pace of business has changed. You know, it used to be the case, even 10 years ago, about 10 years ago, that companies were who they said they were. And because of the adoption of social media and just the speed by which people are now able to communicate at scale, that's just not the case anymore. Companies or brands are who their consumers say they are. And so the power is quite literally completely shifted. And so in that framework, it's become important for companies to become quick with being able to get a pulse on the consumer. And so the word that we have kind of gravitated towards is agile. So like definitionally, I actually don't have the definition in front of me, but it means being able to focus on quick iterative changes. So it's all around, adapting to and asking the questions that you need to ask and being able to iterate on those answers. It's much more a framework around iteration versus perfection. And I think that's probably the biggest point of differentiation. You know, thinking about the disruption in the longitudinal studies that we used to do in market research. In fact, 60% of market research used to be longitudinal studies, and that has completely changed in the last 5 years. And the reason that we had those longitudinal studies was because things were nice and steady. I mean, you know, who watches set-top boxes anymore, right? We're in a completely different, or over the top, we're a completely different way of consuming content. In fact, the number one way that we consume content is now this versus time on TV. So in terms of hours spent, excuse me. So, you know, there with all this level of disruption, and there's a lot more disruption that's being introduced quite literally this week with OpenAI. So, you know, with all this disruption, companies in our industry, companies that are major brands, mom and pop shops need to be thinking, teachers need to be thinking about in an agile way. Again, how I mean that very broadly is simply focus on quick iterative changes.
Yeah, that's there's a lot to unpack in that response. I love that. I love your thinking around it and the context that you provided for why that iteration is so important. Because what you said about how brands used to be who they say they are, and now they are who the consumer says that, like, that is so powerful, that in and of itself. And, you know, I'm thinking just the way content is consumed, as you described, is important, but also the way content is created, where the people who had the loudest voices was a very small number
before social media, before the internet. You know, I remember in college taking a course on, essentially it was on influencers. It wasn't called that. It was called celebrity politics. And it was about how, you know, we treat celebrities as politicians. We treat politicians as celebrities. Anyways, but those were the only voices you paid attention to. And now anybody can have just as loud a voice, if not louder, and have that influence. And so then the need to be agile and iterate, like, really important, and being able to adapt to the rapid changes. That's, you know, that's a great way.
It's a big problem for brands. You know, brands, if you look at the algorithm on TikTok, and TikTok, as you know, is the fastest growing social platform. You've got these cycles that are happening where you'll see a trend, something that's really exciting, that's moving up, and then all of a sudden it'll just go away. And so that cycle can happen in weeks or sometimes days and sometimes hours. Mm-hmm. And yet it will drive a billion eyeballs in that cycle timeframe. So, you know, getting back to the point of agile or speed is another way of thinking about it and focus. You know, how does a company like a McDonald's be able to partner with influencers just in time to be able to take advantage of that trend? Because it's not fun anymore. Like, it's almost like off brand if you're talking about that trend or you know, doing that particular dance or lip syncing that song, you know, 3 weeks after it stopped trending. So, you know, what does the fox say is not going to play today like it did.
So it's like the original, right?
OG, yeah, totally. And that had actually like a 6 month lifespan, but we've seen that anyway. So yeah, to your point, like it's a very disruptive time for brands, and it's a time that every brand needs to be agile.
Yeah, and if they, like you said, the control's not in their hands anymore, right? So they need to be able to adapt to the outside influence a lot more than was necessary not that long ago. Interesting stuff. We could just stay on that topic this whole episode, but let's move on to our actual topic at hand, which of course I don't have my prepared questions in front of me now because
I do.
Maybe you don't need me. You don't need me. I get these back.
You know what though? I do. While it's getting sorted out, I actually have some reasons why companies should use virtual focus groups. So maybe we could pivot to that question and then keep down the discussion.
That sounds great. Let's talk about virtual focus groups and when should companies use them?
Okay. There's really three reasons. There's lots of reasons, but there's three primary reasons. I remember back in the 90s when I started my market research career, my boss, Dick McCullough at Macro Consulting, he told me, he said, there's every customer wants three things. And you already know what they are. They're on the top of the Grit Report every year, which is so funny. It's they want it faster, they want it cheaper, and they want it higher quality, right? And so in the 90s though, but pre-internet, pre-digitization of insights, it was quite literally just pick two. Like, you could not sacrifice, if you wanted high quality, you're going to give up on time or you were going to pay a truckload of money, right? So like you never, it was a three-legged stool, and it was pick which two you wanted to stand on. A little bit precarious. But in today's world, you know, we're continuing to be driven by those three things. And so the three things that I see, reasons why companies will want to leverage virtual focus groups over in-person focus groups, or maybe even other moderations. Of course, it starts with costs. Virtual focus groups get rid of travel. So, you know, in that way, it creates a big benefit on just the bottom line for the research budget. The second reason is just convenience. It's much more convenient to conduct virtual focus groups versus in person. You know, you have a massive time savings because guess what? You're not traveling. And then the third reason is really around wider reach. And I think this is probably one of the more important reasons. You know, it used to be that there were niche audiences that you simply could not do focus groups with. Maybe it's elderly, maybe it's young, maybe they're poor, maybe they're like socio-demographic, whatever. And, you know, you just can't reach them or get them into a facility in that or rural. In that world, we just didn't do focus groups with those subset of consumers. And now you can actually do that. The power of COVID, one of the benefits of it, if I dare say that, is that everybody knows how to Zoom. For every Sunday night, my family would get together, and my parents, who were in their 80s, to our then 3-year-old, would all be on Zoom, and we'd be playing family games. And there's the high level of comfortability that now had been forced upon us to be able to communicate in a digital framework, which just simply would never have happened if that wasn't the case. And so the ability to be able to connect with Micronesias for me is probably the third and also the most important reason why companies will want to consider doing virtual focus groups.
And those are all really great reasons. It all comes down to, you know, having a wider, wider breadth of input. When you're not limited by cost, you can talk to more people. When you're not limited by time, you can, again, talk to more people. And when you're not limited by geography, you can talk to more people that wouldn't necessarily participate in a focus group. And a lot of companies, as you're, you know, I mean, even going back to thinking about what we were talking about with Agile and being able to iterate, you know, setting up these kind of big systems, right? These big initiatives for these focus groups in an effort to be able to iterate on and get a pulse on people quickly, a wide breadth of people quickly. It's just not possible. It's, you know, got to be limited to a different, different initiative, right? It's not going to match up with those agile approaches.
Exactly. Now, I do think that in-person still has a lot of, there's a lot of reasons why you want to do in-person. But, you know, per the question, there is definitely some reasons why you want to when you'd want to prioritize virtual over in person, if at all possible. So, I think that to your point, like in person, there's a physical connection that exists that doesn't happen in a virtual framework. But having said that, there's also a connection that happens in a virtual framework that does not happen in person. So it's much easier, for example, depending on the platform that you're using, for certain participants to be able to participate. So like people that are hearing impaired or what have you, there's a lot of systems that are in place to make that really easy for them in a virtual setting. So anyway, sorry about belaboring the point.
It's a good one. It's a good one. I think that inclusivity point is an important one to double down on. So what are some of the steps that need to be taken in order to successfully set up a virtual focus group?
So there's two ways of thinking about it. One is methodological, and then the other is very tactile. The methodological one is kind of how I'd like to start the answer to that question. So the first thing you have to do is, and this is not complex, is you need to really be crystal clear on what are your goals for the research and what is the expected, what is the hypothesis that you're trying to prove or disprove going in. And that is absolutely vital. The goals should be measurable and they should be actionable. A lot of times I see death by committee, especially in focus groups. Everybody's got a point of view. And if you're doing them, in some order, you know, maybe you're doing 5 in a day or 3 in a day, stakeholders will start weighing in. And by the end of the thing, you know, you've got, as my late grandfather used to say, a camel is a horse designed by a committee, and you want kind of wind up with that. And so really having crystal clear goals is absolutely vital. The second thing is you need to have a clear plan. And this gets to the tactical components of successfully running focus groups or any research project for that matter. There has to be a set of steps that you are using that are just execute against in order to get to your outcome. So thinking about, things in there, platform, how you're going to be recruiting the participants, what's the incentive level, and then really designing the overall focus group schedule. And then the third thing is really just about execution. So once you have the goal, once you have the plan, then it's just a matter about showing up and executing the plan.
Awesome. And, you know, one thing that just popped to my mind as you were talking about, you know, if you're doing 2 or 3 in a day or 5 in a day, like how important is consistency in that plan as you're moving from group to group?
One of the things that happens in qualitative research is after the third or fifth, there's something magical that happens in that thing. Every focus group or every every in-depth interview start sounding very similar to a conversation that you've already had. Mm-hmm. And so to that end, I actually think that having some space in between sets is really good, because it'll allow you to, you know, part of that I think is moderator driven, and we develop a hypothesis, and then oftentimes, you know, as you get more tired, because this is a very draining process, mm-hmm. then it's easier to kind of succumb to these unintentional biases in the conversation and naturally sort of like lead to these points of view that you may have already established as truth. And so, you know, I think the space can oftentimes create an opportunity to be able to recharge. So for me, if I'm doing either one of those two things, I will never do more than three in a day. My ideal is three IDIs or two focus groups. That's kind of like my cap. And because it is exhausting for me, and I do find that my performance, my energy levels are low, so therefore I do a poorer job of actually conducting the focus groups.
Yeah, I think that Zoom fatigue element is an important one to consider, because with any Zoom call, you know, it's just different from being in person.
Totally.
And feeding off other people's energy, and you're just on screen all day long. Like, I can see that fatigue really setting in. And, you know, some of us ADHD people have a hard time staying focused even in person. So in Zoom, it's even harder. That's such a, you know, it's an important tip to like not overdo it and not try to do too many of them all at once. Cause you're right. Like, you know, squeezing in that fifth one in a single day, you're not actually going to get anything out of it if you're not like on top of it. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is a good segue. I wanted to talk about preparing for the successful moderation of a focus group. I think a lot of people are, you know, maybe you mentioned IDIs. Like, I personally happy to jump on and moderate an IDI, you know, if I've got like a clear goal and I know what I'm trying to get out of it, I've got my questions, like I can have a one-on-one conversation with somebody and probe and get to the information I need confidently. But, you know, moderating a focus group is intimidating. That takes a special skill set, at least it seems, right? From me, somebody who's not done it. So what do you need to do to kind of prepare for a successful moderation of a focus group?
So there's eight things that I think you need to do. I know. How's that for my untraditional three? The first is you need to be really prepare the technology. So you need to test the software. You need to test the equipment. You need to make sure that you know how to get into the session and that everything is working right. A lot of times, if that isn't done ahead of time, then you're not prepared and you just kind of like try to wing it in there, because maybe you've done Zoom 1,000 times in the past and it's always worked, but it's that one time, and it'll put you in the tilt mindset. It'll put you on tilt. And at that point, you're kind of on your heels and you're thinking about the wrong things thereafter. And just trying to move into survival mode. And it can be very stressful. The second thing for me is, again, getting back to the need for clarity. You need to have clear objectives. You need to decide on what you want to achieve in the session. And you need to create have a set of questions that are addressing and getting to that topic. The third thing for me is establish ground rules at the beginning. So you need to set the expectation with participants on what is acceptable behavior in the session, and that everybody understands that. And that can be, it might feel a little perennial at the beginning, because you're usually sitting with a group of adults and you're an adult yourself presenting. And so in that framework, it kind of feels maybe a little bit odd. But if you do things like say, hey, listen, I'm just going to be managing time that people are talking. And the reason why is because if somebody is speaking a lot, then, you know, I want to make sure that everybody has an equal opportunity to be able to weigh in on the various questions. So if I have to say, hey, listen, I need to move on or something like that, please don't take that offense to that. I'm just making sure that everybody has an opportunity to be weigh in. So if you establish those kind of rules at the beginning, then it can be helpful when you do have corrective language that needs to be used later in the discussion. For that person not to take offense to it, being like, oh yeah, okay, I understand what the rationale is and why they're behaving that way. And so anyway, different rules apply to different focus groups. They apply to different, there's, you know, ethnicity is a big part of that. I just yesterday did an interview on my podcast talking with a Latina interviewer who specializes in Hispanic research. And you know, it's really, there's a completely different set of social rules if you're facilitating that, you know, that environment, in that environment, versus if you're doing an Anglo focus group. So anyway, that's, establishing the rules is really important. The other one is you want to make sure that you've got the right people in the room. And so I will often, you kind of assume that they're right, but when I'm doing a focus group or even IDIs, I will reaffirm key demographics or psychographics or screening criteria with the participants, just to make sure that they are who they say they are. And then kind of getting back to the front, I think that like welcoming the participants is really important. So there needs to be, you need to have time at the beginning to set the rules. And then you also need to have time at the beginning to make people, to build some level of rapport and trust with you as the moderator and to some degree interpersonally, but really it's important that each person feels comfortable with the moderator. And so I always try to leave about 5 minutes create 5 minutes at the beginning of my focus groups where, you know, they're that just rapport building. And that is, you know, literally I will script in a joke. I'm not a particularly funny person, but I will write a joke and, you know, that kind of thing that is appropriate for that particular audience. Also, you know, introducing the objectives and the topic is great because it allows at the beginning, it allows participants at a high level to kind of internally process what the topic is. And the analogy that I've heard people use, this actually was originally presented to me by the head of user experience from Shopify. And she was telling me, it's like walking into a cave with a flashlight. And when you walk into the cave, you want to be on a broad beam. And the reason why is because you need to quickly identify if there's a bear in the cave. And then as you develop comfort in there, in the cave, then you can start like narrowing the beam and becoming more micro on specific questions and topics. So, you know, making sure that you've introduced the overarching theme or topic or whatever issue that you're trying to uncover, so that people really have a idea of clarity on the conversation track. You need to be engaging is the seventh thing. You have to be engaging with participants. You need to ask questions. You need to shut up and listen. This light's killing me. And I think that's a really important part, is making sure that you're asking pointed questions, but in a way that is respectful. And then the last thing is, you, in a virtual framework, you need to monitor the chat box. So a lot of focus groups, most focus groups are being done on Zoom these days, and Microsoft Teams, not designed platforms for for virtual focus groups. And so in this world, people use the chat box and they're completely comfortable with it. And you should encourage that. And it's okay to get feedback in that mechanism, but you need to include that as a way for you to be able to, as a input mechanism, not just the video and audio.
Okay, there's a lot. And you know me, I'm a note taker, so I write down, that's the only way I can hear what people are saying. And I think I missed number six, but I think I got all of them.
Introduce the objectives and topics. Yeah,
that was my number five. Anyways.
Oh, damn it.
That's all right. I got them all. I think that chat piece that you mentioned is really interesting and something I never really thought of before, but really allowing people to participate in the way that they want to participate. If they want to, you know, maybe somebody is talking more than someone else, all of a sudden that quieter person does have a space to have their voice heard. I think that's actually really a huge advantage that I really hadn't even thought of. I wanted to ask about, you know, starting broad and letting people know the objective and the topic and then kind of going more narrow. How are you thinking about like wording your questions so that you're not leading people down a direction? Like you want to let them know what you're there to learn about without saying, we want to know how much you love XYZ product or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, how do you think about, you know, the language that you use and making sure that you're getting an objective response?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important question that you've asked. The humans, we want to please in a natural state. And so if, you know, you ask me about a product that you represent or is paying you to represent them, I'm going to naturally have a bias towards favoring them. And so a good way to get around that or to rescale that point of view, is to ask them about a competitor or a thing that they may have that may be similar. So I'll give you an example. I did some research with the company was called WebTV. It was an early acquisition of Microsoft into the internet world. But before that acquisition took place, they were struggling with adoption. And so we did a set of focus groups, and we, instead of talking about WebTV as a brand, because it really had no brand equity, and the concept was basically a set-top box on top of your TV that you would be able to plug in to the TV and an outlet, and you would have internet access. So it's basically just like a modem. Think of it like that, but always on. This was a new concept in those days, and there really wasn't a lot of like connection to it. But if you asked people a question, to your point, hey, what do you think about always on internet through your TV? I mean, who's not going to be like, hell yeah, let's do that. But the reality is like the market, they weren't performing that well in the market. And so we were rescaling people's enthusiasm around questions, their answers to questions like, when's the last time you bought a new piece of technology? What was that technology? Why did you buy it? What was the problem it was solving? So, you know, you can start understanding what the motives are in purchase behavior based on similar products that may not be exactly like what you're trying to address. And so you have to be very crafty, and you have to be very thoughtful about the, you know, I call a survey instrument, for example. A discussion guide is a discussion instrument. These are quite literally scientific instruments that we establish. They're not just like a set of questions that we cobble together 5 minutes before the session. I mean, there needs to be a ton of thoughtfulness on those questions. I think from the outsider perspective, if you haven't done a lot of focus groups or in-depth interviews, then they probably seem very simple. But as a practitioner, you understand that there's a ton of science that goes into the actual formulation of those questions. And the reason that they're asked the way that they're asked is actually really, really important.
Sorry about that. Welcome to the show, Henrik.
He's the best part of it anyway.
I was like, oh, so close. I think that your description of it being a scientific instrument is really important. And actually, if you guys are looking for some tips on writing discussion guide, you can head over to Brian Monsheen's Bright Ideas podcast. I think he just did an episode on writing a good discussion guide, but thinking of it that way as a scientific instrument. And I love the approach of like sort of parallel type questions, like similar, but different, yeah. To really get to the root of the behavior or the opinion, as opposed to just point blank,
right,
leading them down maybe the wrong path.
Yeah.
Could you walk us through a successful moderation of a virtual focus group? How does it look from beginning to end? I mean, you just kind of walked through a lot of the steps of the prep, but what's success at each of those stages?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a little bit overlap and redundant in what I just mentioned, but, you know, there is a set of steps that I think you follow that that we didn't include. One is the pre-work that we talked about already. So you need to set expectations and rules of engagement with the participants. The second is at the beginning of that focus group, again, introducing kind of the overarching purpose. Now, you don't need to be explicit. It doesn't have to be the actual purpose of the focus groups, right? But there needs to be a purpose, a framework that a person can understand what they're going to be talking about. I also like to set an agenda with participants. So that was like an outline of the topics. It might be very high level. It might be like, we're going to talk about these three things. But that just gives them a sense of what the journey is going to look like, kind of the Dora the Explorer kind of a thing. And then it's obviously just around facilitating the discussion. The why is the reason you do focus groups is, as a, you know, any quality will tell you, is you get to the why. Like quant will tell you what and qual will tell you why. And so to that end, some tools that you can use obviously is asking why. And I like using the rule of five, which is kind of a root cause analysis created by Toyota. Asking why a lot, you know, can lead you down this really interesting path of discovery to understand consumer behavior. So, you know, the the other thing that I would say is that use empty space to your advantage and use it as a tactic, use it as a way to mine more information. A lot of times people want to fill space. Most of the time people want to fill space, including the moderator. And it's okay if there's that silence because people feel like they need to keep talking. And oftentimes they will continue that discussion. Obviously you need to encourage participation. At the end of it, I like to summarize the conclusion. If I'm doing a virtual focus group, though, I don't stop recording at the end after I summarize the conclusion. I actually don't end the recording until everybody's left the session. And the reason why is there's something that happens. Every moderator that I've ever known will tell you that they're some of the most important stuff that they get out of the conversation happens after the cameras go off. And the reason why is because you move out of the participants move out of a performative framework into more of a true human connection. Like we're having a couple of beers or whatever. And now we're just kind of talking as friends. We spent an hour together. I now trust you. Right. And so you can actually get a lot of gold after you have finished the focus group or the in-depth interview. And then the last thing I would say is, and this is actually really important, is after that focus group is completed, make sure you build enough time in to get input from stakeholders, whether that's in a virtual room or whatever, have some space or a place, or it could even be something like a Google Doc, but have a place for them to be able to provide feedback on what they've heard relative to the key objectives and actions.
That's great. I've heard a lot about the conversation after a focus group and how some people are feeling like they've lost that a little bit in a virtual environment, but I love that you're experiencing that people do kind of stick around at the end for a minute and you still get some of that after group conversation where.
Yeah. I mean, it's all scripted from my vantage point. So the way I mechanically do it is I say, okay, good. This concludes our focus group. This is what we've kind of like the high level things that we've talked about. I really appreciate everybody's time. We're going to be distributing the incentive in the next 24 hours. You know, thank you so much for your time. And then I stop talking. And that's when some really interesting things can start materializing.
That's great. And the other thing I wanted to touch on is your rule of five when it comes to asking why. I was recently at TMRE actually a few weeks back and heard someone from McKee Foods talking about doing some virtual discussion boards with an AI moderator. So here's your, the AI conversation from earlier. Yeah. And that was one of the things she said was when we were reading the transcript, we're like, oh my gosh, this like the chatbot is like interrogating these people. They're like, well, go deeper on that. And they do that like, why, to a point that it's maybe uncomfortable for a human being to do it. Yeah. But what they got out of, that last time they asked, or, it's so valuable, the deeper, the layers that get peeled every time you probe on that question, which I just thought was so interesting. Like human nature, we're like, okay, that's enough, don't interrogate them, but that's literally what they're there for.
It's a voluntary interrogation. I never thought of it like that, but yep, you're right.
That's what they signed up for, to be interrogated. That's but I think it's a good point to say, like, don't stop at that third why. Don't stop at that second why, but just keep going deeper. I love how Rob Volpe says it, that just tell me more about that. Oh, you just said this. Tell me more about that.
You've got to be creative about, you're not just saying why.
Right. You do have to have a conversation, but yes. That's great. And you mentioned stakeholders. I'm curious, first, like, who should actually be doing the moderation? If I'm a major CPG brand, like who should be moderating the focus group? And then who else should be there?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of that, the answer to that question, I think, depends on who's conducting the research. So if it's a professional agency, then obviously you've got a professional moderator. But more often than not, what I'm seeing is inside of brands, you'll have user experience professionals, user experience researchers, so UXRs or market researchers inside of brands that are actually conducting their own focus groups now. It's just that easy. And you're seeing a greater level of involvement in research the process of research across the organization. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One is at Microsoft. Microsoft had an outstanding turnaround story around, I think it was their, I can't remember the product line, Visio or something. Anyway, whatever. So one of their product line divisions. And the way that they were able to do this turnaround, the turnaround was they had a product line that was actually going down in revenue. And they actually had an updated budget that had it going to the top right and over the next 2 years. And so the company 3X'd and 4X'd. In year one, it was 3X goal. And in year two, it was 4X goal. And so it did so much better than anybody else thought it could do. The CEO himself went and met with the team. So congratulating them and then also talking to them. And so what materialized, like when they got to their five whys, like, why did we do so well? It actually boiled down to the research that was done. And a big part of that was how that research was executed. And so the Laudermilk, his first name is escaping me at the moment, I can't remember. But anyway, he was the head researcher for the work that was done. And he involved everybody on the team, stakeholders inside of the team, in the actual research, and had them conduct some of the interviews, some of the focus groups, and had them involved in the crafting of the discussion guide, again, getting to the objectives and actions, and creating the reports. And a lot of times, you know, you could say maybe that's like too arduous and not their job and that sort of thing. But what he found was by getting a deeper connection by the actual people that were doing implementation and sales, that empathy actually translated to the work that their outputs, and subsequently had an oversized market return. So yeah, in terms of who does research, I think now you're seeing it being done across the organization. Now, I've been saying this for the last 5 years, just because you have a scalpel doesn't mean you should be a surgeon, or do surgery. And to that end, I go back to my earlier statement that this stuff has to be science. This is science. This is like people are making multi-billion-dollar decisions on the insights that we surface. And so to that end, like with the Microsoft example, Mr. Laudermilk, he's a scientist, and that work was being done by really smart people, but they didn't know market research or consumer insights at a professional level. And so he was providing that guidance and that safety through the entire process. And then the other thing I would mention, example I'll give you is Adobe. So a friend of mine there, Girish, he heads up one of the divisions and in research, and they don't do a lot of internal research. They use partners for that. But on the brand side, when he leverages a partner, he will involve his team and himself in the actual research from like day one. So getting back to the objectives and actions and the crafting of the discussion guide and all that kind of stuff. And then what he finds is that he has, instead of it being like the formal presentation, which was, you know, how research used to be presented, you would have two meetings. You'd have a kickoff meeting and the presentation meeting. Now they have iterative meetings through the life cycle of the actual project. So that by the time they get to that final meeting, it's more of a discussion on what's the implementation of the research and the actual outcome to our business. Like, what does this actually mean? What are the actions that we're taking? So it's much more of a strategic level as opposed to an informational level. And you can imagine like the shortcut that takes in, that creates in business. But he would say that it does create a longer timeline for the research.
Yeah. I mean, there's advantages, right? It's of, mm-hmm. you know, having that tight connection throughout the process. Yeah. Maybe it adds a couple of days, but what is that worth in the end to being really tightly aligned? And I think it's an important point that you mentioned, you know, really there's the more people that are involved in the research, the better, right? Like of actually talking to people and actually hearing from their mouths, like versus getting a report secondhand, like, you know, that's really important, but without sacrificing the science, which is really important. And I think I've heard from our customers, from others on the show, you know, there's a risk evaluation, right? Of like, you know, let people have at it with low risk research and decisions and iterations. And when something is a multi-billion dollar decision or something like that, like to really think about the perfection and the science. But I think that evaluation and getting more people involved is just bringing more empathy and human centricity into these businesses, which is never a bad thing.
100%.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Shocking how quickly this time has just gone past. It's like I blinked and the episode is over, but I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise with us.
As always, thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks everyone for listening in. We will be back next week. We are chatting with Debbie Schlesinger-Hellman with the art and science of joy. See you then.